We got drunk, really, really, really drunk, and slept together, and she told her parents, so now I'm concerned. This is Empathy When, number 4. Welcome, dear listeners. So, you've just heard some words by the Canadian artist and poet and researcher, Jasmine Reimer, who I'm very happy to welcome here to the terrace today.
Thank you, John.
It's great to have an audience live in the terrace. We're also live on Trope TV, which is a very exciting development. I saw that there was 6 people just before I started, so that's cool. The sun is very high today. It's much warmer than the last couple of days, and certainly the last couple of events that we've done here. Fully blue sky, little bit of clouds. I think the pool is at capacity in terms of its reduced capacity, but I'd say it's definitely all its tickets have been sold. So anyway, that's the situation that we're at right now. It's the 18th of July, 2020. My week in terms of COVID has been fine. I bought an expensive face mask out of desperation because I just really needed to go into shop. But if I always leave my house without a face mask.
So you think because it's more expensive that you'll take it with me? With you?
Yeah, right? I mean, I should. Or like, at least, you know, not lose it. But it's still tricky. I don't know.
It might just hurt more when you do lose it.
Yeah, probably. It's a bit like face masks, I feel, are like the new umbrellas that you buy them to lose them, kind of.
Or lend them?
Yeah. Well, that's, you shouldn't be lending your face masks, but yeah. So it's great to have you, Jasmine. You're originally from Canada. You've been in Berlin for a couple of years now.
Yeah, that's right. I've been here for 2 years.
Okay, cool. You studied at MD Carr, and you have an MFA from the University of Guelph. I can't pronounce that.
Guelph.
It's a beautiful... where is that?
That's in Ontario.
And is it a city or?
It's a city, yeah. It's, let's see. I guess that would be southwest of Toronto.
Mm-hmm.
I think it's southwest of Toronto. 90 minutes on a good day on the highway, 3 hours on a bad day.
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
That seems so far away from the current moment.
It does, doesn't
traffic.
It?
Yeah. You have a practice that's both... visual art practice, and you also write. Your criticism has appeared in various publications, such as the Capilano Review, Border Crossings, Femme Art Review. You also have released a book of poetry that we'll be getting deeper into today, Small Obstructions, which also was an exhibition of the same name.
Yeah, that's right. So in 2017, I had an exhibition at Georgia Sherman Projects in Toronto. And rather than hire someone to write an exhibition text or me providing some kind of elaboration on the text, I decided that to use the poetry that I was writing at the time as the text for the show. So in association with the body of sculptures that I was making.
Awesome. So should we go ahead then with your reading? I probably left out a big chunk of your biography, as I always manage to do, but I think that's... they're the key brushstrokes that I needed to get in. So should we just go into the reading?
Sure. If I could just say one thing about,
yes,
about the
please.
Book. So it's divided into 3 sections. The first section is poetry that I wrote pretty much literally about the work, about the sculpture. And then the second section is about my response to the city, my studio, my apartment, just my general environment at the time. And then the last section is very much about the heartbreak that I was going through at the time when I wrote this book of poetry, which was pretty heart-wrenching. And now, luckily, I'm not in any state of heartbreak at all. I am the exact opposite. And now when I read that last section, it's quite... moments of it are quite tender and touching to me, and moments of it are just extremely embarrassing. So I am going to try and read one, at least one poem from every section, but we'll see how it goes. I might bail on the last...
I started the podcast by reading an excerpt from one of those poems.
Those last sections.
But maybe we can cut that out because I hadn't gotten your agreement to that.
No, I mean what you wrote was perfect. It was, or what you read was perfect. Not a problem. Okay, so I'll start with a poem called No Longer Empty. The texture is pencil crayon green. The will of the space is preserving its void, and I care less about my trysts. Your image is fading? It clings to both sides. I submitted my best proposal to a rock and climbed in empty. The texture is salt screen white. The association of death and the moon indicates a painful separation, an unhappy period of solitude. Opt for liberation intact. Your image resurfaced as a flower trapped in its own wilt. Small units. The texture is rainy and gray and multiple, and the feeling is mutual, and I fucked it up being honest. Little blue empty promises are nothing compared to the thoughts of others. Your image seems kinder now. Activate my spaces. So the poems are quite short, so I'm going to read five. And the second one, which was actually read in Toronto during the run of the exhibition at Georgia Sherman Projects, I did a poetry reading with this book with Magdalena Suksi and Stephen Thomas. And we read this one together. So the second one is called Emotional Freedom Technique. Do not be polite when you say goodnight. Ladies and gentlemen never get laid, and they never make art, and they never get respect. Tap your forehead with two fingers and repeat. Even though I am afraid, I accept myself for who I am. Then tap your wrist and repeat. Even though I accept myself for who I am afraid. Why re-worry all the worries when you can make up new, wholly terrifying ones that are in turn manifested in reality? It's on NPR. It's on CNN. It's playing out in front of you. So much is in the front. We greet people from the front, hug in the front, we start kissing in the front, we zip up in the front, we rub up in the front, we look at ourselves in a mirror that is held up to us with the most shameful illustration of what we actually are in the front. From now on, I'm staying in the back. Back rows, back rubs, back in line, backpacks, backward ways that acknowledge living experience. The third one is called Ways Out from the World. I'm 75 and I'm going to use up my art supplies and die. I'm 76 and the screech whining of the subway hurts my ears. I'm 77 and I can't stay awake on the bus and I miss my stop. I'm 78 and the little bird bits of food keep me going for a long time and make me nap mid-sentence. I'm 79 and my knee won't stop bouncing and it's not because I'm antsy. I'm 80 and I need someone to help put my backpack on and take it off. I'm 81 and I hold tightly onto my bag and it's the only personal thing I have left to take. I'm 82 and I can't remember the taste of red wine and red meat and I can't say. I'm 83 and my town didn't always used to be this way and there used to be warmth and love and the way you're supposed to feel. I'm 84 and my dream and my career are no longer mine and I've given it to someone. I'm 85 and the word adapt is for the young and I no longer care. I'm 86, and my body puddles in my chair, and I like it. And I like it. I'm 87, and I'm supposed to do the inviting around, and I don't, because I'm 88, and those blue seats on the subway are for me, and I don't even leave the house. I'm 89, and I don't sleep well because I rethink all of life's events and re-worry all the worries. I'm 90, and I'm going to burn up all the candles, and I'm going to die. I'm 91, and I can still think poetry. I can still breathe music, and I can still hit rock bottom. I picked all the really sunny ones for this sunny day. I thought I'd rather talk about death than love today for some reason. I don't know, maybe that's just how it goes. Number four is called Afterlife. The best part of being a mummy is the wrapping. Not unlike a baby swaddling. The fabric floss between fingers, legs, and underarms. To meet your maker, bridled bound and charms. Each swath dipped in some egg milk mixture, scarlet bulbs, cinnamon, and crystal tincture. Discreet offerings float the body on peace petals. Soft will be the silence in your temple of metals. Swim until you breach the sand, the heat inferno glittering land. particle by particle, body breakdown, return to us, tiny pockets of light, reflect in a window, come into sight. And the last one, fifth one, is note to self. When you try to control your breath, you are trying to control the future. When you try to control your breathing, you have fallen into the past. When it is your time to go, just walk quietly.
Note to self. When you try to control your breath, you are trying to control the future. When you try to control your breathing, you have fallen into the past. When it is your time to go, just walk quietly. So that was the same poem read, obviously, by a different person. Jasmine, you invited me to read some of the same poems.
I did, yes.
Because you already prefaced your reading with the note that you have done this on the publication of this book.
We did, yeah. So that evening in the gallery with Stephen Thomas and Magdalena Susi, one of the audience members asked, I'd love to hear all three of you read the same poem. And so then at that point, we picked two from the night's readings that we had already read so far and read them back to back. So me and then Stephen and then Magdalena. And it was really interesting because each of us interprets words differently. Each of us interprets the cadence and the impact and the speed very differently, which creates kind of a different poem. And so I suggested to John that maybe, or to you, sorry, you're sitting right here, that we do the same thing today because it makes for a more interesting reading, I think.
Yeah, I mean, do you want to just maybe, should we just choose another poem that you haven't actually read yet and then do it again?
Sure.
I do want to get back to this poem, though, this particular note to self, but we can do that. We can do that after. I guess the term for this would be like tandem reading, a tandem poem or something. It's definitely an interesting experiment, I think. Certainly also in the intimacy of a podcast, because you've got the readers, you know, up close and personal, and people do interpret words very differently. So,
We could do one that was also done that evening. It was called To Be a Bowl of Tangerines. It's on page 60. So this is the one that's published in Blue Stem magazine by the University of Eastern Illinois. Okay, so to be a bowl of tangerines. Listen, when I die, I only regret the diets and the one-upmanship. I would have loved to fix your hair, flipping it to the cool side, just like you, when you're self-conscious and talking too much. This would have made me feel needed and intimate and attracted to you. Oh, I also regret the obsession with women who I wanted from my mother. You know who. We could have been pure citrus terrific, a bowl of tangerines, cupping our small companion breasts, gone naked with your dog like in the 70s. Funny thing is, the truth of the matter is, what I'm getting at is, sometimes my obsessions turn in on themselves, watching me watch them. You never looked that far away.
To be a bowl of tangerines. Listen, when I die, I only regret the diets and the one-upmanship. I would have loved to fix your hair, flipping it to the cool side, just like you, when you're self-conscious and talking too much. This would have made me feel needed and intimate and attracted to you. Oh, I also regret the obsession with women who I wanted for my mother. You know who. We could have been pure citrus terrific, a bowl of tangerines, cupping her small companion breasts, gone naked with your dog like in the 70s. Funny thing is, the truth of the matter is, what I'm getting at is, sometimes my obsessions turn in on themselves. Watching me watch them, you never looked that far away. Yeah, great stuff. It's also interesting because you've got like words that are, obviously, in the English language, we don't gender our words in a demonstrative manner like in other languages. But actually, of course, we do all the time in the sense of I always think of Joyce was wanted to finish Ulysses with yes, because he termed that to be a feminine word. But yeah, so it's interesting when you've got things like breasts, even though men have breasts too, I guess, like it's somehow in this context, when you read first, it like immediately puts in mind the place that you're talking about, women, and also the mention of my mother, an obsession with women who are wanted for my mother. I don't know, is that sexist of me to think that would be a immediately come to mind as a female?
Well, I don't know. I mean, when you read it, I realized how equally powerful it is for a man to say that.
Sure.
You know, I mean, Oedipus, etc. But I don't think it's sexist. I think I like the difference. I like that. I think when you read it, there was a different kind of sensitivity, and maybe that's because I've read these way more often than you, right?
Maybe. I mean, I also think that, you know, the question with poetry is maybe something similar to with the question that you get with fiction, which is like, where do you stand in relationship to the content? Is this all a poetic eye that's, you know, strictly speaking, authored by you?
Yeah, I think...
Which is actually a question for this book. All the poems that you've just read and that are in this book, you know, first-person experiences.
Mostly, I would say over 3/4 of them are. Yeah, definitely from first-person perspective. I was going to say, the way that I think about it, I think the way that I approach writing is the same way that I approach making art, visual art, in that I'm trying to create a world. So I think... somehow, even though I have these three categories within the book, it's a whole world that's happening, right? It's me, but it's a woman experiencing making art from the inside and from the outside. It's a woman experiencing her city and her friends and her commute and her apartment from the inside and from the outside. And when I say from the inside and the outside, I mean the felt feelings that you have when you're having an experience, and also what that might be just in terms of actions taken. So not objective, but you know how you have a sort of witness inside of you that sometimes comes out and just shows you what it looks like to be you walking down the street? Whereas in you might be having all sorts of incredibly powerful feelings, but then suddenly this subconscious person or this witness person comes out and says, but look, it's sunny and the grass is green and the flowers are there, and like all the feelings that you have don't match up with what you're seeing on the outside.
It almost sounds like... some mindfulness technique or the opposite, disassociation.
No, it is. Well, it is kind of part of a mindfulness practice. It's a bit of a Buddhist thing to develop the witness.
Right. Because, yeah, I have a lot of trouble myself with kind of what's the classic phrase, you know, when you start to think that your thoughts are real, kind of, and that reality is actually, you know, your fears, for example, of walking down the street, that something terrible is about to happen, even though, of course, objectively, nothing's going to happen.
Right.
But maybe you should talk a bit about the context that you did write this in the sense that it was published on the occasion of an exhibition. We're in an oral conversation, but in the link, we can have a show, in our show notes, we can have a link to documentation of the exhibition. But do you want to just describe, in your own words, the visual experience of this installation that the book accompanied?
Sure, yeah. So it was an installation of sculptures. So it was 27 sculptures, all made using found objects, sand, paper mache, and then cast objects that I had made especially for these sculptures. So cast objects including cast rubber figs, cast rubber dates, raisins, avocados, and then I did another thing where I started covering things in rubber. If I didn't feel like I could make a skillful cast, I started lathering silicone layer after layer after layer on top of objects such as flowers or bugs. You know, I would find all these dead bugs in my studio, so I just started slathering them in silicone so they were encapsulated. And then I would slap that encapsulated bug on the sculpture. So if I were to describe just one of them, which sort of represents the series, the found object, which acted as my armature, was a diaper genie.
And a diaper
genie.
What's a diaper genie?
It's a really expensive designed garbage can for diapers. It's made by Playtex, and it's white, and it stands about a meter high, and it's got a pedal And when you press the pedal, the top opens up.
Does that mean you've got like a meter worth of dirty nappies?
Well, no, there's disgusting. No. I, of course, took the dirty diapers out. Right. So it was just the can. And inside, there's a blue plastic tube. Blue plastic garbage bag specially designed for a diaper genie. So it's very skinny. And the diapers go into this bag. Once it's full, you can open it up halfway, and it kind of cinches the bag so that it's all very hermetically sealed so that the parents don't smell the least amount of smells as possible.
Ah, okay.
So the thing is that it's kind of a beautiful thing, this diaper genie. I mean, it's this like white sort of bullet-like sculpture that you put in your house to put shit in. And I started seeing them in the thrift stores. The thrift stores in Canada are very different than here. They sell all sorts of objects and everything. So I started seeing lots of them in thrift stores because, like, a baby doesn't need a diaper genie forever. So I started collecting them, and then I started even renting cars and going around to the suburbs and picking them up from people who were selling them on Craigslist. And lo and behold, I had, like, 20 of them. So then I covered them in this mixture that I made of paper mache and sand, colored sand. So all different kinds of colors. And then I started sticking my cast objects inside them. So they're these anthropomorphic a bit, very visceral. They're bumpy, lumpy, but also evocative of maybe natural landscapes because of the sand. And I installed them in the gallery after painting the walls gray and lowering the light considerably, and then removing other light sources, like blocking out the window. And they had this big garage door with panels of plexi, and I blocked all those out, leaving just little holes in the blockage so that little light rays would come through. I was hoping for some kind of cave-like experience.
Yeah, I when you described the exhibition to me last week, I pictured a kind of a more totalizing gesture in the sense of kind of physical cave-like creations or something. But then when I saw the documentation, I could see actually how, like, subtle use of what you had to play with you deployed. And it was like, yeah, probably very did it smell a certain smell?
I don't know. I mean, perhaps it smelled like...
And it was winter?
Yeah, it was February in Toronto. So there was actually quite a bit of sun in February in Toronto, right? So people would come in from a bright day.
But lots of snow outside.
Not so much, maybe. I don't know. I don't remember. But I was often told that people would come in from a bright day and they would have to stand at the doorway for quite some time until their eyes adjusted. The photographs, you know, we had to turn the lights up to photograph the works. Otherwise, I couldn't really document what they looked like. So the photos that are online or will be online are not quite totally accurate of what the experience of seeing it was. I actually got denied a review, an art review, because she said she couldn't see the work.
She couldn't see it live in person?
She said she couldn't see it well enough to write about it.
Okay. Wow.
So it was dark. But I was quite happy with the exhibition, actually. And there was little bits of the sand, paper mache crumble that I used to make them all around the floor. And it was a bit gritty when you walked.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, I guess we should just to finish, like, on the point of the subject of both this book, poetry, and you could hear it in the poems you've read today, this idea of the inside and the outside, and I guess defecation and this idea of, like, putting diapers in kind of hidden space, effectively, you know, they go... goes from, not to make this too scatological, it goes from the inside to the outside and back inside something. Of course, it's very much a human trait somehow. But the theme of the show and this body of poetry, is it safe to say that it explores the meeting point between the inside and the outside?
I would say it's safe to say that most of my practice is about a relationship between the interior and the exterior, and the often contrasting... a glaring difference between some type of embodied experience, but what lots of philosophers and writers talk about as an embodied experience, which is actually sometimes completely false. You know, like things do not match up between the threshold of in and out.
In a mental sense.
In a mental sense, but my practice is very much rooted in a more visceral bodily exploration of those sensations.
Okay. And so I also want to, you know, always go back to the theme of the visual arts relationship to text and literature and vice versa, and how literature, you know, can elucidate and help explain, much like we've been trying to do, or you've been trying to do just now, a physical or a visual experience in a gallery. What is your take on poetry's... I mean, you've written a poetry book in relationship to an exhibition, so you must have some kind of an opinion. Do you have anything...
Well, I think poetry isn't... I don't think poetry is a suitable text for all exhibitions, right? I think it depends on the work, and so... My work had been described at that time as a little bit absurd. You know, I was using diaper genies to create sculptures, right? That's not necessarily, I don't know what the right word would be. It's maybe an absurd approach to making sculpture. Uh-huh. And so poetry for me is a way to use language in the way that I think language is actually best suited. Because I don't know about anybody else here, but I often... find that regular day-to-day communication language fails us time and time again, right? Like we often struggle to feel understood even though we're all using the same set of tools. And so when I write poetry, it feels incredibly freeing and gives me a sense of like lightweightedness because I'm able to use the words as texture. I'm able to use the words as I would make a sculpture. They're found objects that I can string together, assemblage like piece by piece by piece to create an overall cohesive thing. And that thing for me is a world, right? I'm always, you know, I'm working on something now in the studio and I'm hesitant to present it as individual sculptures. I want to make an installation. I want to make a world so that people understand that it exists as a part of an entire cohesive entity, that there is a system that these things belong to. And so this book of poetry came sort of at the end of me making those sculptures, the small obstruction sculptures, but I felt like it was a parallel world, that these words belong in the world where the sculptures exist. You know, that there was a texture, there was a cadence, there was a slipperiness or a visceralness to some of these poems that the sculptures also exhibited. Or I think that was my aim, anyway.
It's a good metaphor for, or a good description of also of how a book works, like the system that you were talking about in relationship to world building. In a sense, when you put things between the cover of a book, you are already kind of cutting them off from the rest of especially nowadays, digital culture, I guess, but also, you know, you're drawing space, you're drawing words into the same space. So I think that like that's a nice crossover description. Concern or topic or theme from the poems that you read, the poem Ways Out from the World, is something I've noticed in other writing of yours that I've been lucky enough to read recently, which is perhaps the idea of aging or the aged figure. So to go back to my question about like who is the poetic I in these poems, if it's, you know, all written, you kind of have this, I'm 75 and I'm going to use up my art supplies and die. And you go from, you know, 75 to 91, I believe.
Yeah.
And I found this poem really, it's interesting that, you know, you chose to read it because I found this very telling somehow. Or what's going on in this poem?
Well, I think it's fear.
Right.
I think, you know, when I like to kid myself that I'm really going to enjoy my old age and that I'm looking forward to it and I can't wait and perhaps I'm already there. I'm just in a 39-year-old body. But the truth of the matter is it's a huge unknown in everybody's life. Nobody really knows what's going to happen. And so I'm a mixture of curiosity and terrified because I don't know what my fate is going to be. And so I observe the people in my life who are over the age of 65 or 70 with great respect and curiosity because I'd like to see how they're handling it. I am curious about their experiences. And it's a bodily experience that I can't have at this moment, right? I think it really, there's something about the aging body that is beyond boundaries. It's beyond our sense of convention and it's beyond our definition of the way things are ordered in our world. right? And so for me, to put language to that kind of experience is really fascinating, because this kind of goes back to what I was saying about assemblage. I'm an orderer. I like to put things in a certain order that is my logic. And so that's how I write poetry. That's how I make sculpture. And somehow aging is an order that I can't fully grasp. And yet it's the most natural, consequential thing that is going to happen to every single person. It's perhaps the most universal thing.
So to force, as I like to do, look at the title of this series, Empathy When, would this suggest that it's difficult to empathize with those older than us? In the sense that we haven't...
Maybe, yeah. I think that's a huge conversation, but I think it's more that we haven't found a culture, or at least I would say the culture that I was raised in, Western Canadian culture. It's not about empathy. It's about making space for the different set of skills, abilities, attributes, speed. It's an exclusion instead of an inclusion.
Yeah. I mean, it's true. I think, like, Western culture is, like, absolutely terrible at acknowledging, you know, old age and what that means, and ultimately death. You know, it's a dead person is not a very good consumer of goods, and, you know, the anti-capitalist in me has always suggested that, you know, the religion of consumerism, you know, can't really account for old people and death ultimately.
And I think, sorry, just one thing, I just had a flashback of when I was writing this book. When you're going through a heartbreak, which I was at the time, somehow life gets sped up and you're dying, right? You're old and alone and you're dying, because that's how you feel in that moment, right? So suddenly I felt, maybe I didn't feel empathy for the people around me who were old, but I certainly, I identified in a certain way, like the ache that you experience when you're really going through emotional trauma, you know, you're really turned upside down. Your body is not really yours. And so I think suddenly when I was on the trams in Toronto, the old people became a particular focus to me, because I was just like, I feel you, you know, like I am slow, I'm depressed, everything hurts, I'm alone. And, you know, like you are my people for the momentary time until I get through this.
Yeah, that's definitely emphatic in one way. And I've never really thought about heartbreak in that sense, but it's true. So I always have a quick fire round of questions in my great podcasting repertoire. So do you write with a pen and paper or computer and keyboard?
Pencil and paper.
Including these poems?
This book I wrote on the Notes app on my iPhone, because I was constantly commuting.
Ah, okay. So it's an aberration. It's like not... It's
normally exception. I don't do that. But
okay.
Yeah.
You have been here writing on the terrace with a pen and pencil.
Yes.
So I believe it. Hamburger Bahnhof or CEO Berlin?
Hamburger Bahnhof.
Forward crawl or breaststroke?
Breaststroke.
Spaghetti or fusilli?
Fusilli.
Ah, interesting. I always find fusilli, it's dangerous, because it can be soft on the edges and hard at the little bow tie.
I think that's what timers are for. You got to put a timer on it.
I like to freestyle it when I cook. It's terrible. Much to my mother's... displeasure during quarantine. I said, this is avant-garde cooking. And of course, you can't bake without timers and measurements. And so there was a couple of disasters in my quarantine kitchen. This has been really fascinating. And do you continue to write poetry in relationship to your visual art? Or was this a kind of confluence of circumstances, so to speak?
After this, I didn't write any poetry in conjunction with my art until I got to a residency I did last winter in New York. I did the ISCP residency, and I wrote one poem for the installation I did there.
Okay, great. Yeah. And should we read one last poem as a segue to the great silence of...
Maybe page 20, To Perform Rituals. I want to perform rituals for something that is already over. Is that a funeral or a seance? Maybe I'll burn Palo Santo, direct it towards the high and low spots. Maybe I'll sing thick, abstract tones and phrases until even I think I've been possessed. Maybe I'll French kiss finger every one of my stones until they're smudged with lipstick and the gods can no longer answer their beam. I started writing shortly after that last night. The night, if we were Aztecs, our gods died and the world was reborn. So thank you for that.
Shall I read? Okay. To perform rituals. I want to perform rituals for something that is already over. Is that a funeral or a seance? Maybe I'll burn Palo Santo, direct it towards the high and low spots. Maybe I'll sing thick, abstract tones and phrases until even I think I've been possessed. Maybe I'll French kiss finger every one of my stones until they're smudged with lipstick and the gods can no longer answer their beam. I started writing shortly after the last night. The night, if we were Aztecs, our gods died and the world was reborn. So thank you for that. What's that? What's that about? Is that about rituals?
The night our gods died? That part?
No, the whole poem. It's like it's kind of dark and saucy at the same time or something.
So basically, you know, I would start writing a poem and then I'd be in my little apartment and I would gaze around and something like my rock collection would motivate the next line, you know. So and this is kind of why I kept writing poetry, was that it was fascinating to me, to myself, in a selfish way, that the same way I write is the same way I make sculpture, right? Like, put a whole bunch of stuff together, look around, nothing's happening. Oh, a pot. I need a pot, you know? And it's piece by piece, object by object, word by word. And so everything in this book stems from a terrible but also kind of silly one night event that left me incredibly heartbroken. Okay. And so inevitably, no matter what, if I started writing a poem about objects, it would, and my feelings for this person, these horrible feelings, would come up. So there's always kind of this turn of sadness into anger into sadness.
Right. Yeah, I think that really comes across, and definitely is kind of, maybe darkness is not the right term, but some kind of shadow. Yeah, and that poem represents it. So to finish, do you have, I feel like you have a bit of wisdom somehow to give over to our listeners about that image of when you were walking down the street in relationship to the Buddhist idea. How do you deal with kind of invisible or indistinct kind of anxiety or fears in relationship to the physical world? So like the inside fear and the outside threat.
I think it's certainly, like you said, a mindfulness technique, which is like any other mindfulness technique that anybody else could learn, in the sense that you're really trying to be present. And so I think the trick is to not identify yourself with your thoughts, right? Like your phrase was, when your thoughts become reality, right? And that's all it is that you've identified so much with the thoughts in your head instead of what's actually happening in this physical plane of existence, right? You don't see the trees anymore. You don't hear the water anymore. You don't hear the kids in the pool. It's, do I look okay right now? Does my voice sound okay? There's something in my eye. Can you see it? Is my hair all right? Like, it's just this constant radio broadcast of inner turmoil, right? When, like, you can't hear that. Nobody else can hear that. It's only for me.
Yeah.
And so I think my trick is, the witness comes in, who is also a part of me, but not a part of me, which is something I maybe can't explain. The witness comes in and says, hey, but nobody else but you sees it. So what is John saying to you right now? What does the wind feel like? You know, mm-hmm. What does this drink taste like? What mm-hmm. does it feel like to have my leg up like this on the stool? And I think that's why I'm interested in embodied experiences, because your body is telling you things all the time. It's just a language that we need to learn.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, I find grounding techniques really help me, because I hate this whole breathing thing. When I start thinking about my breath, that's when you know, that's when the world really starts to end.
Yeah. I listened to, if I could just add one thing, maybe we're way over, but I listened to a really nice podcast this morning, and this woman, it was with Sharon Salzberg, who's like a master famous meditation Buddhist teacher, advisor. And she had a woman on this morning who said, okay, we're going to do this meditation practice together. And through the podcast, she said, just put both feet on the ground.
Mm-hmm.
And right. So I did. And then she said, now pretend that the world is going to support you. And think of how it won't ever stop supporting you. It's not the world, the earth is not going to fall away.
Mm-hmm.
And to just let that feeling of like solidity enter into your body, let like seep up your legs. And I have never really thought about it that way before, right? That perhaps we're all just a little too jaunty on our feet, you know?
Yeah.
And that maybe that's adding to this constant, like, you know, thought factory.
Yeah. Yeah, totally. It's a beautiful image to end on. So, yeah, thanks so much for coming and sharing your work and introducing us to the worlds of Jasmine Reimer.
Thank you, John.
Thank you all for coming. Thank you all for listening. Thank you all for streaming. This reading and this particular episode has been made in the context of Reality, the 2020 exhibition at Tropez Berlin. It was produced and mixed by Jemovit Novak, also known as Jemik. Thank you to him. Executive producer is Nela of Tropez. It's hosted by me, John Holton. Please do like and subscribe and follow us on Instagram. We would all like to see you wonderful Berliners here on the terrace for the coming weeks. We're here every Saturday or Sunday. Do check out the program, and I'll catch you next time. Goodbye.